morning. To commemorate the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, we are going to recite a parak of Tehillim. It is Tehillim Mem Vav 46, which, as it happens, was recited this morning by President Barack Obama. If everyone could please rise. I'll recite it first in Hebrew and then in English. Lamnaseach lubnei Korach al alamos shir. Elohim lanu machaseva oz, Ezra vitzaros nimsema od. Al kain lo nira behamir aretz uvimod harim belev yamim. Yehemu yechmeru meimav, yir ashu harim begav aso sela. Nahar pilagav yisamchu ir Elohim kidosh mishkene elyon. Elohim bekirba baal timot, yazreha Elohim lifnos boker. Hamugayim matumam lachos, nasam bekalot hamug aretz. Adonai tzvaos imanu miskavlanu Elohe Yaakov sela. Luchu chazu mif'alos Adonai asher sam shamos ba'aretz. Mashpis milchamos ad k'tzei ha'aretz keshes yishaber v'kitzeitz chaniz agalos yisrof ba'esh. Harpu udu'u ki anochi Elohim arum ba'gayim arum ba'aretz. Adonai tzvaos imanu miskavlanu Elohe Yaakov sela. For the conductor for the sons of Korach, the Alamos, a song. God is for us refuge and strength, a very accessible help in distress. So we shall not be afraid at earth's transformation and at mountains' collapse in the heart of the sea. Its waters will rage and be muddied, mountains will roar in his glory, Selah. The river, its streams will gladden the city of God, sanctified dwelling place of the Most High. God is within it, it shall not falter, God will help it at the break of dawn. Nations roar, kingdoms totter, he raised his voice and the earth will dissolve. Hashem of legions is with us, a stronghold for us is the God of Yaakov Selah. Go and see the works of Hashem who has wrought devastation in the land. He makes cessation of wars to the end of the earth. The bow will he break, sever the spear, and wagons consume in fire. Desist. Know that I am God, I shall be exalted among the nations, exalted upon the earth. Hashem of legions is with us, a stronghold for us is the God of Jacob, Selah. May we only share simchos from here on in.
Adina, thank you so much for starting out our morning in such a meaningful way. Thank you all for joining us on this somber September 11th morning. It's also this year's first installment of Midrashet Yom Rishon. And we would like to thank Leslie Litsky for generously sponsoring today's shiur. We are so thrilled to be kicking off our fourth year of shiuring today with Dr. Rivka Teitz Blau. Dr. Blau received her BA from Bardar College and her MA and PhD from Columbia University. At Columbia, Dr. Blau was the founder and officer of Yavneh, the National Religious Students Association. Dr. Blau was the principal of Or Torah in Riverdale, New York, and of Shevach High School in Queens. She is the author of Learn Torah, Love Torah, Live Torah, Harav Mordechai Pinchas Teitz, the editor of Gender Relations in Marriage and Out for the Orthodox Forum, and is a member of Tradition's editorial board. Dr. Blau and her husband, Rabbi Yosef Blau, are the proud parents of Rabbi Binyamin, Rabbi Yitzchak, and Rabbi Yaakov Blau. Thank you, Dr. Blau, for being with us today.
You open with praise for your hosts or hostesses, as the case is here. And I'd like to commend the committee, and in particular, Orit, with whom I dealt on the phone so many times over the past few weeks, for the way that you organized this. It's a pleasure to see so many people that I know or whose parents I know. But I must mention one person who actually knows me from before anybody else in this room, who was even at my wedding. That's Mrs. Lila Silverstein, and it's a very special pleasure to see you here. It means a lot to me. Thank you. You can tell we go back a long way. I'll just tell you how this talk is going to be divided. I'm going to talk about women in Tanakh for a bit, and women in Gemara for a very short time, and then we're going to talk about what kind of learning has taken place over the centuries for Jewish women. And then I'll get into the 19th century, which is where it began. And I must mention right now that all the day schools across the world are following essentially a curriculum that Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch made in the 1850s and the 1860s. Rav Hirsch believed in universal Jewish education for every Jewish child, girl and boy. And in his school, girls learned exactly what boys learned. He is the one who pioneered the idea of having Limudei Kodesh, of having Jewish studies, and having secular studies all in one school. And we've all been benefiting over the past 150 years from the foresight of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. So I just think that's an important thing to know. This is a much longer history than one might realize, and there was formal Jewish education for women happening already, at least in Frankfurt in Germany, in the 1860s. We'll then look at what went on in different parts of Europe, then the United States, and then we'll look at the state of Jewish education today. Just to mention the beginning, something that Miriam Klein Shapiro, Alah Shalom, told me, a joke that she in turn heard from the shamas in her husband's shul, but it really is indicative of what has happened. You all know that in Am Haaretz, it literally means a person of the land, but it means a person who's not knowledgeable in Torah, a person who's ignorant. And that the Am HaSefer is the Jewish people. We're supposed to be the people of the book, the people of Torah. So Miriam told me this is the joke that was told to her. Originally, we were the Am HaSefer, and all Jewish people knew a great deal of Torah. Then, as knowledge of Torah became less and less, especially in the United States, we started concentrating on, well, if you're a Jew, at least you have a tie to Israel. So she said, we became the Am HaAretz. She said, now we're restoring Jewish learning. We're becoming the Am HaSefer again. We're becoming the nation that learns. And I see it even in the difference in my own family. I was taking my niece Esther to a gathering, and we were talking about whether we should say the Al HaMichya or Bein HaPashos in the car and then lead into Filas HaDerech, into the Yehi Ratzon, asking for a good trip. And my reaction was, well, Yossi says, Yossi being my husband, Yosef Blau, and Esther's reaction was, well, I looked it up. And to me, that is the difference in 20 years' time between I was told and I know how to look it up myself and I can find the answer myself. That's the wonderful thing that has happened now, that young women can find the answer themselves. And after all, what are they looking at? What are we all looking at? We're looking at a Torah where women had such a primary role and showed so much intelligence, so much initiative, whether it's Sarah, the founder of Jewish womanhood, the first Jewish woman, for whom Hashem said to Abraham, to her husband, Kol shetamari lecha Sarah shema b'kola, whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her voice, ki b'yitzchak yikarei lecha Sarah. Sarah is the one who understood that it was Yitzchak through whom the lineage would go, and not Yishmael. In the same way, we see the intelligence and initiative of the other imahos, of Rivka, of Leah, of Rachel. We see the way that Miriam reacted to the Shibud Mitzrayim, the slavery in Egypt, telling her father Amram that he should continue having children, that if the men all separated from the women, there would be no Jewish children at all, and that would be worse than Paro's decree. And of course, Miriam, who ultimately led the women in Shira, led the women in singing after we crossed the Red Sea. We see the Bnos Tzlachad, whose love for the land of Israel led them to bring a question to Moshe Rabbeinu about how they might inherit the land that would have gone to their father and what the proper laws of inheritance should be. And of course, their brilliant solution. They married within their shevet, they married within their tribe. And that way the whole problem of land going out from one tribe to another tribe right at the founding of Israel as a Jewish country got solved by them. But how are they described in the Gemara? They're described as, put my glasses on to give the right words, they're described as Chachmanios, Darshanios, Ahavos, Eretz Yisrael. They were brilliant women, they were women who now knew how to interpret the Torah, and they were women who loved the land of Israel. We see Devorah and Yael, between them, getting rid of Sisera. We see Chana, the mother of Shmuel. And in fact, there's a joke that Uriel Simon, the professor of Tanakh, tells about the parents of Shimshon, of Samson, because when the angel first appears to the mother, she's always described as Eshes Manoach, the wife of Manoach. And after all, she's the one who understands that it's an angel. She's the one who asks for a second appearance. She's the one who explains to her husband, this angel is not going to be able to eat the offering that you're giving. It's an angel. So she's the one with the greater insight. So Uriel Simon said, what is the name of Shimshon's father? He's the husband of the Eshes Manoach. Because that's the way it's always described. And we see the bracha, the blessing that Boaz gets when he marries Ruth. And it's Yitain Hashem es Isha Habal Beischa Korachal Uchlea Asher Banu Shtehem Espes Yisrael, hoping that Ruth and Boaz between them, that through this woman whom he's marrying, they should build a house in Israel. So certainly we see a pattern of women being very important, women being very understanding, and the intelligence of women being very much respected. There's one source, and this source is on your source sheet. It's the first one. It's in Hebrew. It's the one that's from Gemara Sanhedrin. And there's one person here, Atara, who knows that this is one of my favorite quotations. In the time of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, Badku midan v'ad ber sheva, v'lo matzu am ha'aretz, migivat v'ad antipras, v'lo matzu tinok v'tinokes, ish, and I underlined, v'isha, shlo hayu b'kiyin v'chochos tuma v'tahara. The greatness of the time of Chizkiyahu was that in his time, they could go the length and breadth of the land, from Dan all the way north to Beersheba all the way south, from Givas to Antipras, and not find a boy or a girl, a man or a woman, who was not completely versed in the laws of purity and impurity. Now those are very difficult halachos, very intricate halachos. But to show you how good the knowledge of Torah was at that time, but you notice it says, a man or a woman, a boy or a girl. Everybody knew, and that's the ideal in Jewish life, that everybody should know. You all know the different stories of Brau Bruria and her brilliant comments. If somebody said something to her that she felt was said in too many words, somebody asked her, Be'eisa derech nilech li'ir Lud, with what road should we travel to the city Lud? She said to the person, you're not supposed to be saying so many words, and don't be so verbose. You should have just said, Be'eis l'lud. Which way to Lud? You should have just said it very simply. When her husband was upset with ruffians who were disturbing him and indicated that he would be happy to be rid of them, she quoted Tehillim Kuf Dalet, she quoted Psalm 104, Yitamu Chatam min Ha'aretz v'lo Chotim. It says sin should be eliminated from the land. It doesn't say sinners. You would hope that you would bring the sinners around to proper behavior, but you don't wish for the end of the sinners. You wish for the end of the sins. That's what you wish for the end of. And there are many other examples of Bruria's brilliance and many stories told about her, many comments given that show just how insightful and how incisive she was. We're also told about the wisdom of Yalta in the Gemara. And later on, we learn about the wisdom of the Benos Rashi, the daughters of Rashi. And the tradition is carried on in our own time. In the 1930s, the Ragat Shachar had passed away, Rav Yosef Rosen, and he was called Sachnas Paneach, Revealer of the Hidden, the same name that was given to Yosef when he was in Egypt. And that's why his Sfarim were all called Sachnas Paneach. He revealed hidden things that nobody else could have thought of. The Ragat Shachar was an unusual genius. And his daughter saw in 1938 what was happening in Europe. She was living in Israel. She and her husband, he was a Rav, had settled in Israel. She went back to Latvia, which she knew was a dangerous thing to do, and all her friends were urging her not to do it. And she went back to Dvinsk, which is where her father's Sfarim were, and she copied onto microfiche, onto microfilm, all the Ha'aros, all the comments that her father had made at the sides of his Gemaros. And she sent them off together with Rabbi Alter Safran Fuchs, who was the rabbi in Dvinsk, who had relatives in the Bronx. She sent off all those microfilms and got them all out before the Nazis overran Latvia. Unfortunately, she and the rabbi were murdered by the Nazis, and those microfilms remained there for many years until a member of that family, one of the Safrans, happened to be sitting near Rabbi Menachem Kasher at a wedding, and told him, you know, we have all these microfilms in our house, we don't know what to do with them, and describe them. And that's how the Sachnas Paneach started to get published. So it was Yad Hashem, that Rabbi Kasher should have found out where those microfilms were, but it was the daughter who saw to it that all that learning should be preserved. And in the same way, let her live and be well, Rebbetzin Bruria David, whose maiden name is Huttner. She's the daughter of Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner, who is the Rosh Yeshiva in Berlin. She happens to have a doctorate in Near Eastern Studies from Columbia. She's also the head of Beis Yaakov Yerushalayim, of BJJ. And I have never asked her directly if she's the one who did it, but the word is out that she's actually the one who edited Pachad Yitzchak, her father's work, and got it published. So we do have a history of learned women, and of learned women helping to get learning out to the world. Of course, now we also have women who get their own word out to the world. And for example, the best example I can give is Nechama Leibowitz, and the fact that she revolutionized the study of Chumash, the study of Tanakh in our time, and raised the study of Chumash many levels and affected the way that every student everywhere in this country is studying Chumash right now. Now, we come to some of the stories that we have about Europe. The myth about Europe is that women were staying happily at home, busy cooking and busy sewing, and that was what women did in Europe. Totally a myth. First of all, in order to earn a living in Europe, everyone had to work. Everyone had to work. There was no such thing as separating off your job, my job. And I must mention something else that's very important to know. No one stayed in Kollel for longer than 5 years in Europe. That was the outside limit, was 5 years, including at Slabodka. And my father told me that when he came to Slabodka, there were 18 people in the Kollel out of 400 young men in the yeshiva. And of the 18, two of them were, one was Rav Yaakov Ruderman, who went on to found Neir Yisrael in Baltimore, and another was Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who became Rosh Yeshiva Tzar Vadas. That was the quality that you had to be in a Kollel. And even they, it was a 5-year limit. After that, you had to go out either to be a Rav, and a Rav was expected, of course, to continue learning for the rest of his life, to be a Melamed, you could go out to teach, or you could go out to go into any other kind of work you wanted. Women did many kinds of work. For example, the Rebbetzin in each community had the option of taking a particular field to be her own. My grandmother took wine making, and she made the wine. Everybody bought their wine from the Rebbetzin. Other Rebbetzins took candles. Other Rebbetzins took sewing goods. But whatever monopoly the Rebbetzin took, that was hers, and the whole community helped to support her and her family through that. There were other things that women did. Women were very involved in trade, were very involved in business, were very involved in commerce. I had an aunt who in the 19-teens, before she and my uncle went to settle in Israel in 1920, she used to go through China every year together with a group of friends. They would buy fabric in China, and they would come back and sell it in Latvia and Lithuania. So these women were certainly very enterprising women. And anybody who says that the women were just sitting at home in the kitchen doesn't know the reality of what life actually was. Not only that, but they did learn. You had to learn how to read Hebrew in order to be able to daven. And I may just be very blessed that I had this, but both of my grandmothers daven 3 times a day. It's from them that I learned that a woman is supposed to daven. And of course, you have to be able to read Hebrew in order to daven. It depended on the community, but in certain places, parents got together and they would hire a tutor in order to teach their girls. So for example, a woman, Elizabeth Elka Summer, told me that she was living in a small town called Trysk in Poland. And during World War I, there was a prisoner of war who had gotten caught there in Poland. He married a girl from Trysk, but he was a very big Lamdan. He wanted to teach. So the parents hired him to teach the girls. This came about because I heard her speaking Hebrew at one point, and I asked her, Mrs. Summer, where do you know Hebrew from so well? And she told me it was from when she was a child, and he taught them Chumash, he taught them Navi, he taught them whatever it was that the parents asked him to teach the girls. So there was some private learning going on for girls. In learned homes, the language in a learned home is the language of learning. The language in a yeshiva town is the language of learning. So just from the atmosphere, a great deal was picked up. My father loved to tell about the landlady in Slabodka when he came there, and each boy was given a chalukah, was given a certain amount of money, a certain portion, and had to go out and find his own place to live. He saw a room that was beautiful, freshly whitewashed, everything about it clean and airy, but it was a pretty high rent. And he said to the woman, look, I'd love to rent your room, but it's really pretty expensive. I'm going to look around and see what else I find in the afternoon. And he came back at the end of the day, and he said, really, I didn't find anything to compare to your room, but it's so expensive. She said, I'll give you another night to think about it. Don't worry. Ainam Akudeshes. It hasn't been betrothed. And my father was so taken with the fact that a landlady in Slabodka knew Ainam Akudeshes is the way to describe, I'll give you another night. The transactions are complete. He rented the room on the spot. He said, so I'll eat a little less, but I'm going to live in the room that this woman owns, because she says Ainam Akudeshes, to say you still got time to decide. That's what life was like. The air was full of learning. And people pick things up that way. And certainly in learned homes, people automatically pick things up that way. I'm not going to read the whole set of four paragraphs, but I translated from Hapelis, a rabbinic journal that went at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, a description of a learned woman and the fact that when her father and her brothers wanted to know where something was in the Gemara, they would ask her, because she knew so well where different things were located, including once when her brother wanted to know where something was, and she thought about it, she said, I think it's in Erechin, which very few people study. And yet she was so learned that she could give the source. This was a woman who was quoted in Yagdil Torah, a Torah journal, in the 1880s, because she gave such a good answer to a question that was raised at the Shabbos table, that her brother printed her answer under her name in Yagdil Torah, in the Torah journal. So this is a very different picture from the ignorant woman who is kept away from knowledge. I'm not saying that everybody had the benefit of being in such a learned home, and that's one of the great things that's happening today. It doesn't mean that your father has to be a Talmud Chacham, or your brother has to be a Talmud Chacham, or your husband has to be a Talmud Chacham who's willing to teach you privately. Today, anybody who wants to can go and learn. Anybody who wants to invest the time can take courses. Anybody who wants to do it at home, through the computer, there is so much that's available now. I won't even go into all the programs. If anybody wants a list, I'll make up a list and give it to you of different ways that you can study at home and be part of a class. The Web Yeshiva, I think, is one of the best inventions ever. I think that's the reason Hashem let the computer get invented, so we could have Web Yeshiva, and that we could have virtual Beit Midrash. There are just wonderful things available today, and you can do it, as I say, in the privacy of your, in the privacy of your home. Now, how did it all begin? When did formal education begin? I told you it began with Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, and we have to think to ourselves what was going on. The whole idea of mandatory education and the whole idea of formal education is only a few hundred years old. In 1400, 1300, nobody went to schools. You first started having schools for girls in general, in the whole community, only maybe 200, 250 years ago. Until then, it was all private tutoring that was being done. So the whole idea of schools for girls, we have to think in the whole Western culture, was something that was pretty new. And as I said, in the middle of the 19th century, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch already said his school had to be boys and girls learning the exact same thing. One of the people that he influenced was Rabbi Yosef Karlbach, who got caught during World War I in Kovna, which is in Lithuania. If you look on the map, it's listed as Kaunas, K-A-U-N-A-S, but Jews call it Kovna. And while he was there, he founded a high school for girls. It's interesting that Rabbi Karlbach's granddaughter is Elisheva Karlbach Jaffin. Elisheva Karlbach has been named the best teacher in Queens College for a number of years running. And now she is the professor of Jewish history at Columbia University. When Professor Yerushalmi passed away, Elisheva Karlbach became the professor of Jewish history. So it's fascinating to know that her grandfather, Rabbi Yosef Karlbach, is the one who founded the girls' school in Kovna. And that girls' school, in turn, became a very significant catalyst for other schools. Now, World War I, that means it was between 1914 and 1917. Why do I point this out? Because 1917 is the year that another school got founded. And this is probably the first name that you think of when I say education for women in Eastern Europe. Who do you all think of? Beis Yaakov and Sarah Schneerer. Okay, and I give full credit to Sarah Schneerer. I have enormous admiration for her. But there are a lot of things that are not quite the way they're presented, and there's a little bit of I don't want to use the word propaganda, but there's a little bit of slanting the story that's told about her. For example, she was not just the simple seamstress. She was a very sophisticated woman. Unfortunately, she had a divorce behind her before she made a happy second marriage. And when she started the school, that was a tremendous thing in Poland, but would not have been an unusual thing to do in several other countries. However, what she did was remarkable, because Poland did not have a history of schools for women. She started that first Beis Yaakov in Krakow in 1917, and she deserves enormous credit for it. And she was very wise to get support both from Misnavdische and Hasidische great people so that she could answer any critics in Poland immediately. Well, if the Chafetz Chaim approves and if the Gerer Rebbe approves, why would anybody disapprove of having education for women? And it very quickly expanded into a tremendous network of schools. The person who helped her was somebody who had been trained by Rabbi Karlbach, Rabbi Dr. Karlbach. Rabbi Yosef Karlbach had two doctorates, one in mathematics, I don't remember what the other one was in, but he was a very intellectual, learned man. And Dr. Leo Deutschlander, who worked with him, who also had a secular doctorate, is the person who helped Sara Schneer organizationally to get the Beis Yaakov network to get going. In 1919, Rabbi Yosef Leib Bloch, who was both the Rosh Yeshiva in Telz and the rabbi of Telz, they had a system of the same person who was Rosh Yeshiva was also the rabbi in town, asked Rabbi Karlbach and Dr. Deutschlander to found a network of Yavne schools. Yavne was the name of the school, and he wanted to have a network going throughout Lithuania and Latvia. They made a teacher's seminary in Kovna to train the teachers, and they made what was called a gymnasium, which was the word for high school in those parts of Europe, in a number of other towns, including Telz, including Panevėžys. And why do you think I mentioned those particular cities? Because you all know the Telz Yeshiva is famous, the Panevėžys Yeshiva is famous. Rabbi Kahaneman refounded the yeshiva in Israel after World War II and called it Panevėžys again. It came to include approximately 100 elementary schools and then a number of high schools as well. And now, if you will please look at the source sheet, because it's interesting to see what went on in some of these high schools. I told you about the first mention, the quotation from Sanhedrin about the time of Chizkiyahu when everybody was learned. Now look at the gymnasia in Torah V'Derech Eretz, which is what the school was called in Riga. First of all, you have a picture of the building, and you're told, it's in Yiddish, that there are three divisions. First, there's a kindergarten, which you can all read there, one kindergarten. The Roman numeral 2 is a Grundschule, which means an elementary school, a basic foundation school. And number 3 is a Mittelschule, is a middle school. But look what's written below that. Unterricht Sprach, the language of instruction, is Ivrit. Everything was taught in Hebrew. And that was true in the school in Telz as well. If you'll turn the page over, please, at the Yavne school in Telz. Here's the Hoda'ah, here's the announcement, in Hebrew on the right and Yiddish on the left, that they were founding a school. Incidentally, I read in several different places that the school was founded in 1921. It was actually founded in 1920, because you see when it's listed as being founded, it's in that first paragraph, Achar Chag HaSukkot, Tov Resh Pei Aleph. Well, after Chag HaSukkot, Tov Resh Pei Aleph is 1920. It would be Tov Resh Pei Beis if it would be 1921. The same way that we're in Tavshin Ayin Aleph now, so if something happens Sukkos Tavshin Ayin Aleph, it means it happened last fall. If it's going to happen this fall, it's going to be Tavshin Ayin Beis, even though the year is still 2011. There's always a difference of 3,760 years between the Hebrew date and the English date, but somebody here subtracted 3,760 from Tov Resh Pei Aleph, from 5,681, and got 1921, not thinking about the fact that it was before the turn of the year, it was Sukkot, so it was still 1920. But look what was going to go on there. They were opening 4 classes of the high school, and a machina was 2 classes, and then there's that little parenthesis saying that if there will be an interest in addition to these 4 classes, we're also going to open machlakot hagvahot me'elu. We'll open upper classes, l'sheyimaseh lehen mispar ro'ei shel talmidot. If we find enough students, then we're going to open upper-level classes as well. in the end, La Briotte, in the end, this gymnasium was so good that Ribson Usband, who is now in Cleveland and is associated with the Tells there, and who is, let her live and be well, so 120 good, healthy, happy years. She's in her 90s, Kanahara. But she went to this school, and she told me that the school was so well recognized that if girls wanted to go on to university, they could just take exams and cover the first 2 years of university after they finished those two post-high school years at the gymnasium in Tells, at Yavne. That's how good it was. But look what they studied. Look at those mikzaot ha-limudim. The first one, of course, is Ivrit, and everything was conducted in Ivrit. Now, when I saw this, when I read about the school, I called Rebsen Usband and I said, you had math in Hebrew, you had biology in Hebrew, you had chemistry in Hebrew. She said, everything in Hebrew. And she said, not only that, during summer vacations, to make sure we would keep up on our Hebrew, the teachers would write letters to us in Hebrew, and we all had to answer in Hebrew. And we would get it back corrected. But we all had to be involved in Hebrew. The only way we were going to be able to go on in Jewish learning was if we knew Hebrew really well. I found that fascinating, that 90 years ago, there was already such a recognition that you must have Hebrew in order to go on. But this is very typical of Europe, where people are, or were, accustomed to being multilingual. Look at the languages that every girl took. Hebrew, Lithuanian, Litaet, Ashkenazit, they all took German, Rusit, Russian, and Sarfatit, French. Everybody took five languages. And in fact, I interviewed another person, Rebsen Goldschmidt, may she live and be well, who lives in Yerushalayim, who's over 100 years old, thank God. And she went to Yavne in Kovna, and she told me that in Kovna they had their choice. It was either French or English. And she doesn't know why. She said she was a young kid. For some reason, she decided to take English, not French. And as it turns out, when she married Rabbi Goldschmidt, who later became a dayan in Israel, he wanted to get out of Europe. It was the late 1930s, and he had been in Hebron. Thank God he wasn't massacred in the 1929 massacre in Hebron, but he still had papers permitting him to go back to Palestine, issued by the British government, and he was able to bring his wife along. That's how she and her husband were saved from the Shoah. And she said, who knew when she was a kid choosing English instead of French that was going to turn out to be very valuable? Because when she came to Palestine in the 1930s, knowing English for dealing with the government authorities was a big plus. But five languages. Look what else they studied. Chumash, Nevi'im, and Chumash, I was told, they did with many Mefarshim. They may not have had Torah Shebaal Peh as a subject. They didn't have Gemara as a subject. But certainly if you're studying Chumash and Nevi'im with Mefarshim, you're certainly getting plenty of Gemara that way. Halachos v'agados, which I find interesting because the agados had to come from the Gemara, so that's an interesting way to get to study Gemara. Korosa Ivrim, Jewish history. Historia Klolis, general history. Mathematica, you will recognize mathematics. Geography, science. Meleches Yad, which I think must have been handcrafts. I don't know whether it meant embroidery or sewing or what exactly it meant, but certainly that in 1920, that would be something that would be done in a girls' school. Siyur, they had art. Zimra, they had music. And Hitamut, exercise. And then it gives the rest of the information you have about when there will be entrance exams and when you have to get application. Yes.
Just out of curiosity, and you sort of alluded to this, but what proportion of the women would have been able to attend a school like this, even in this area? Because, I mean, that these would have been families that wouldn't have needed them to be working. And
Right. And also, first of all, even to have the knowledge to go in, they had two machina level classes.
Right.
They had two preparatory classes for the girls who didn't have the knowledge to go straight into a gymnasium. No, it had to be a family that was very dedicated to its daughter getting an education.
And also a very wealthy family, right? Because, I mean, I think...
I don't know about wealthy, because the whole attitude of educators in Eastern Europe, and this I heard many, many times as I was growing up, Mrs. Silverstein is laughing because she knows that was the policy, money should never prevent a child from getting an education.
No, I didn't mean the money to send the children, but the idea that if they're... historically, if anybody, any child, boy or girl, is in school, it means they're not at home helping the family business. My understanding was that it was never everybody who went. It was always a select, you know, if you had six kids, so one or two of them might go. But
that I have to, you're raising a very good question. I have to look into that. I'll have to find out about that.
Okay.
I have not even thought of that. That's a very good question.
Because way before this, but, you know, I'm sure you've read the Glück auf Hamelin story, you know.
Like, right.
She talks about, only a couple of her children were able to get educations. The other ones all needed to be involved in business. It wasn't, couldn't send everybody out.
Yeah. Which means I really have to look back at my father's parents with great appreciation, because they sent all their daughters to that Torah Vayera school in Riga. They sent five daughters there, and they sent five sons to yeshiva, and they were not rich. And yet all 10 of their children got an education. But I do have to consider, how did other families look at it as well?
Okay.
Excellent question. Yes, what else? Yeah.
In conjunction to that, I see that you have all the sciences that were being taught also. Was that a compulsory education from the government?
Not yet. But it was going to become. But they were ahead of the government on this. They were giving what was given in a top school. In fact, that was the private discussion that I heard about from the women. They wanted to make sure that everything was done the way it was being done in the top schools. That there should be no sense of you're getting an inferior education if you're going to a school under Jewish auspices. And I think that has guided us all along. Why are all the schools busy announcing how many students got SAT scholars awards and all this kind of thing? We're still into it. We're still trying to prove that if you go to a yeshiva high school, you're going to do just as well as if you went to the fanciest private school. Yes?
Perhaps this is something that you're going to get into later, but what is very striking to me is the contrast between what you're presenting and the traditional view that's being put out today, and what's appropriate is being put out today in certain segments of the Orthodox Jewish community.
Well, now you know, I know why when Orit asked me to speak, I chose this topic.
So the question is, to me, is, you know, given that this is such a high level of learning, seems to be supported by such Talmidei Chachamim who are prominent and revered in all segments of the Orthodox community, is what led to the revisionist view of history and this not being seen as the ideal?
Okay, does anybody have any thoughts about that? Why did things reverse themselves? And why did it start, a train of thought start of don't let the women know too much? I'm trying to think how that started. What would you think?
But I think it's a general, in history the pendulum is always swinging in different directions, and I don't know necessarily that the swing towards, I'll say, minimizing knowledge is just towards women. I mean, if you go back and you look at what the yeshivas looked like, 75 years ago, maybe even 50 years ago to 100 years ago, but they're bearing the same names, they don't look the same as they do today, and so the whole approach is very different. So I think it's the one thing where it's uniform, that it's all swinging towards what I'll call a more limiting, and maybe it's also a reaction to the world around us. That's how the pendulum swings. Then when it swings in the direction where many young people feel stifled, then it, perhaps history shows that things start to open up a little bit more. I
think you're giving an excellent answer, and I'll tell you another way it shows itself, and this is interesting because we talk so much about women's clothing, but just in men's clothing, look at any of the pictures of the yeshivos from the 1910s, the 1920s, the 1930s. The young men are dressed very stylishly. They're wearing light-colored suits. In the summer, they're wearing very interesting Panama hats. In the winter, they're wearing very interesting, stylish winter hats. And in fact, there was an emphasis in Slabatka, for example, from the altar from Slabatka, the person who headed the yeshiva, who was the spirit of the yeshiva, he wanted a young man to always look very fresh, very modern, very, very much that a young boy should look at him and say, if that's what a yeshiva bacher looks like, that's what I want to look like. And of course, no idea of men's clothing having to be uniform. I know that my father was very taken aback when he saw all these yeshiva guys. Everybody's wearing black slacks. Everybody's wearing white shirts. He said, what happened to individuality? Where did this happen, that this became the uniform? Because in Europe, what was very highly prized was your individuality. And somehow it got ironed out here in the United States into conformity. And I'm sure the pendulum is going to swing again. I think you're absolutely right. And we're now, if you look at a picture of yeshiva guys, if they would take the whole yeshiva again the way they used to with these panning, these panning cameras, you'll find all of them dressed almost identically. And I'm interested in knowing 25 years from now or 50 years from now which way the pendulum is going to go. So that may be part of what's happening. I'm going to take more comments. Just one second. I just want to say a few more things, then we'll take comments. Just one interesting thing at the bottom, that there, if anybody's interested in coming from out of town, the below the line is underlined that says Bakashot Lihikanes La Gymnasia, the next line, that there's going to be a group set up, a committee set up, trying to find places for girls to stay who come from the surrounding area, which means that there was an understanding that, yes, Telz could be a center with all the Telz Rosh Yeshiva wanting their daughters to go, and with the town being very much an intellectual town, but if girls want to come from elsewhere, encouraging them to come and saying we'll try to find places for them to stay. Just one quick thing, and I want to take everybody's comments, but I just want to look at a few more quick things. One is on the reverse side of the page, where you have the Tachnit, where you have the program for the Chanukat HaGymnasium, for the opening of the gymnasium of the high school. Look at what the program was. The first thing was they had a shir by a makhela. They had a choir of girls singing. Now, I know this was true in Lithuania and Latvia. It was not true in Poland and other places in Europe. But in Lithuania and Latvia, the Litvish way was that if it was a group that was singing together, or if it was a family that was singing Zmiros together, the girls sang Zmiros, and the girls sang. And I know that's something that's been lost now, and now we've just all adopted the custom of girls not singing. But, in fact, it's interesting. I'm friendly with Rev Yaakov Kamenetsky's daughter-in-law, and I said to Ruthie, what did your father-in-law do about this? He certainly grew up with girls singing at the Shabbos table and the other table. And she said what he did was, if people were coming over for the Shabbos meal, he wouldn't sing Zmiros at all, because he was not going to have Zmiros and not have the girls in the family sing. So if people came over to visit, there just weren't Zmiros that day. And then when it was the family by itself, of course, everybody, the men and the women, all sang Zmiros. So it's interesting that they had a choir singing. They had a Ne'um Psicha Shel Adoneinu Moreinu Rabbeinu HaGaon Af Beis Din Depo Sheyichel Yamim Tovim Baruchim. That was Rav Yosef Bloch, who had asked for the school to be opened. And then they have the different people speaking from the administrative board, from the director's board. That's Dr. Levy, who was trained by Rabbi Karlbach. And since this inauguration of the building was held at Hanukkah time, there's the Birkas Neros Hanukkah. Then it's interesting, where was the second part held? This was the first formal part, where you had all the different talks by all the different people from the board, from the faculty and such. The second part was held B'ulam Ha-Ri'inoa, the Kina. You know what that is? That's the cinema. That's the movie house. The second part was held in the movie house in Telz, and that was held at 6 o'clock in the evening with a talk from the Bad Hanhala, and then again a choir singing. And it's interesting to see what they had as the program. Gimel is Zimra, is song. Dalet is Brachot HaChagigah. He is declamim, declamatory, because orations, speaking, that was a very popular thing to do at that time. Then Zimra again, then Tmuna Chaya, a kind of living portrayal of Jewish history. Talucha min hagalal le'eretz Yisrael ayadei ha-talmidot, and then Skira. So it's just interesting to see what the program was and what the approach was in a very, very Torah atmosphere place, with the blessing of the person who was both the Rosh Yeshiva and the Rav of the town, and that was the inauguration. Now, before the Nazis, Yichmamach Shmon, took everything away, there was a seminary for teachers that was made in Telz in 1928, and there was a school that was opened in Ponevizh in 1928 that Rav Yosef Kahaneman saw to its opening. There were schools in Kelm, in Dvinsk, in Lepo, in other towns that I can't even pronounce because I don't know how to pronounce these Latvian and Lithuanian names. And interesting, as of 1938, the Beis Yaakov schools, there were 230 Beis Yaakov schools in Poland that had about 27,000 students. That was what Sarashnira's innovation had led to. The Yavne schools, the kind of school that I'm describing, there were 235 of those schools. They were mostly elementary schools that had 23,000 students. There was a group for Chalutziyut, very much emphasizing going to Israel and emphasizing Hebrew and very much emphasizing studying the Bible and modern Hebrew literature. And they had 270 schools with 38,000 students. Those are mostly in the Baltic states, in Poland and Romania. There were also schools in Latvia that the Agudas Yisrael started that were called Moria. And there was a Tachkamoni school in Warsaw that was founded in 1920 to train teachers for the Mizrahi and the Avne schools. So now I understand when I hear that schools were named Moria in this country to begin with, or were named Yavne in this country to begin with, they were harking back to those schools in Europe. What's also interesting to see is that there were Shulamit schools in Europe, and there was a rabbi who came here who wanted to start a chain of Shulamit schools across the country. The one that remains, of course, is the first school for girls founded in the United States, the Shulamit School in Borough Park in Brooklyn. That was founded in 1929, and one of the guiding spirits behind that, one of the founders, was Necha Rifkin, who also did all those beautiful songs for children and stories for children. She was really a very major force in elementary school education for children in general and for girls in particular at the Shulamit School. And in fact, he wanted to found a network of Shulamit schools across the country, just like the schools that had been in Europe under the different names, Yavne, Moria, and so on. And I found out after I had written this book about my father, I knew when I wrote the book that my grandfather had started the Yeshiva in Elizabeth twice, once in 1920, when my mother was 6 years old, and again in 1930. And I knew the story in the family that in 1920, when he started the school, he was criticized and he heard people were whispering, Rabbi Prail is starting that school because he has a daughter who's 6 years old. And he got up in shul and he said, Rabosai, I hear Echer, I've been critiqued, that people are criticizing that I'm starting a school for my own daughter. And he said, Irhat Rath, you're absolutely right. Zias Eichet, Ayidish Tachter, she's also a Jewish daughter. Yeah, I'm starting the school because my daughter has reached the age of needing it, but everybody needs it, and my daughter included. That school lasted for 3 years, and he could not get enough people to enroll children. It closed. And then again, he started the school in 1930, and I only found this out by accident at an airport in Israel while waiting for the luggage, and someone started talking to me and found out that I had Elizabeth in my background and said, you know, I went to a school called the Shulamit School there that existed from 1930 to 1934. That was when I found out that the second school that my grandfather founded was called the Shulamit School, and he meant it to be part of this network of Shulamit schools. But again, it didn't last. So when the Jewish Educational Center started in 1940, when my father founded that school, that was the third attempt to start a school. That one, thank God, took off. But I know that a friend of my son, Seth Farber, who wrote a book about Rabbi Soloveitchik in the end and about the Maimonides School, he really intended to write a book about all the schools that started and didn't last. There was one problem. There were no records. He couldn't find records anywhere because when the school didn't last, it just closed and the records got lost. And even the two records that I had were just two pieces of paper that had been saved in the family. Otherwise, I had no record of either one of the schools as well. So it's interesting to see that there were beginning attempts. Now, you all know what has happened since then. After the founding of the State of Israel, and after all the losses that we went through during World War II, there came a recognition in this country that we must do something and we must teach our kids. And day schools really took off after World War II for a few reasons. One was the idea of rebuilding life here. Another was that teachers came among the refugees where people could actually teach. There had not been many people who could teach before that in this country. And when you think of the heroism of those people who came through the hell of the Shoah and came here and taught children, I shiver when I think of it. What courage and what strength these people had to pick up, rebuild, and say, we're going to give over to another generation. And then, of course, the founding of the State of Israel. Until then, there had been a lot of embarrassment about being Jewish and a lot of feeling of anti-Semitism and a lot of fears. And suddenly, those fears were gone, and there was a new affirmation of Jewishness. And, of course, the history since then, as you know, is that where there were two high schools for girls in 1948 in the entire country, and they were both in Brooklyn, Now, Baruch Hashem, there are high schools for girls all over the country. And when girls continue their learning now, there are so many places for them to go. There's a website called www.seminarycentral.com. It lists 53 schools in Yerushalayim for girls for post-high school study, 4 schools in Tzfat, 2 schools in Gush Etzion, of course one of them is Migdal Oz, which is headed by Esti Lichtenstein Rosenberg, 3 schools in Beit Shemesh. 72 programs for girls to study in Israel after high school. When I graduated from high school, there was Beis Yaakov Yerushalayim, which was not a serious school until Rebbetzin David took it over, and there was Machon Gold, which was a co-ed school at that time. And those were the entire 2 choices that there were for girls in 1958. So we really, it's amazing what has happened. We have to be aware of the fact that there are other strains besides the one represented here. For example, there are many Hasidic schools which have a very different curriculum of Limudei Kodesh from the one that would be in the typical day school. So, for example, there are schools that are really teaching Torah Shebaal Peh. They don't give the girls the text of the Torah, and they teach the girls Baal Peh. But it's an interesting reversal of Torah Shebaal Tam, Torah Shebaal Peh that's going on there. There's schools that emphasize Dinim. There's schools that emphasize Tanakh. Many schools teach Mishnah to girls now, and there's schools that specialize in teaching Gemara to girls. And I won't give the whole list of the schools that teach Gemara to girls. Thank God it's a long list. But it's a wonderful thing to see that now anybody who has an interest can find a school and can go there and study. You see the difference even in the 2 books that Tamar El-Or wrote. She's an Israeli anthropologist, and she wrote one book called Educated and Ignorant, which was about a Hasidic group of women who do get an education, but they don't get an education to know more than what their mothers knew. So it's a very limited education. And then she did another study of women in the Medrashah at Bar Ilan, and she called that Next Year I Will Know More. The Shana Haba'ah, she was talking about next Pesach, I'll know more than I knew this year. So there's both strains going on at the same time. Some groups that are holding back, and some groups that are going very much forward. We have the wonderful, wonderful program that Nishmat founded of Yod Sot Halacha, and you have one right here in your midst, Atara Eis. And I think that's a tremendous thing. I know that my daughter-in-law, Noah Jesselson, took the course and is on the line 2 nights a week, where she just goes into a room, closes the door. She has a special line there, and from 8 o'clock at night till 12 o'clock at night, she answers questions from all over the world, women calling in with questions. And she said she is so impressed with what a great thing this was to have a woman answering women's questions in all the halachos of Jewish marriage, because questions get asked to her that a woman would never ask a man. And she feels it's just very important that they had the halachic training and the medical and scientific training to know when they have to tell people, we have to go to someone about this. You have the Scholar Circle Drisha. You have GPATS, the Graduate Program for Women in Advanced Talmud Study at Stern College. You have Toanot now, who are able to go into Israeli courts in behalf of women who are getting divorced. There's a wonderful new program called Sahali, which is a pre-army program to prepare religious young women who are going into the army, both spiritually, halakhically, emotionally, in every way, for what army service will entail. You have a Haredi college for women that was founded by Adina Bar Shalom. She's a daughter of Rav Ovadia Yosef, and she herself, in the original Sephardi tradition, was trained as a seamstress and became a very, very fine seamstress. And then she said to her father, you know, when people in our community need a psychologist or need a social worker, they're going to people who have no idea of what our community's norms are all about. We have to train people ourselves. Her father said, fine, and she founded a brilliant college. It's in Yerushalayim. It's brilliant in so many ways. First of all, she started with psychology, social work, and computer science, things that nobody could object to, and things where she could prove the direct relevance either to earning a living or to helping the community through studying these fields. But of course, in order to get a college degree or a master's degree, one has to study everything else that's involved in a college degree as well. What she did, first of all, was to make a program, it's either 1 year or 2 years, of preparation, because most of the women in the Sephardic community had not passed the Bagrut, had not taken the matriculation exams, so first she gives them 1 or 2 years of preparation. Second of all, she gives babysitting services. And I visited this Haredi college for women, and you see there's such wonderful care being given to the children. These kids actually looked happy in daycare, and I'm a person who's very averse to just sticking kids into daycare. If I think kids looked happy, they were really happy in daycare. And of course, if the mother has to be called, the mother can be called out of the classroom if there's chas v'shalom a problem, but they're right there in the same building in two beautiful big rooms full of wonderful equipment. So the children are taken care of, the preparatory program is taken care of. And of course, there was criticism. There were certain newspapers where she was roundly criticized for what she was doing. And she went and, oh, she made arrangements with other schools. She made arrangements with Hadassah, with Bar Ilan, with different universities, so that her accreditation is through the fact that she has instructors from these universities, and she is piggybacking on their accreditation to get accreditation for the courses that she's giving. I mean, it was just brilliant all around. In every way, she's not cutting corners. She's doing everything the way it should be done. At the same time, she's helping these women to get degrees with which they can go on to either earn a living or serve the community. Two interesting things. When the criticism came, she came to her father and she said, people are really criticizing this and there's a lot of sentiments against it. He said, this is so typical of a certain kind of rav. What do they know? They're journalists. I'm a rav. I'm telling you it's okay. Pay no attention to any of those articles. So she paid no attention to any of those articles. She made a college. That was number one. That was an attitude you have to take. Number two, what has happened since then? Her program ends at 4 o'clock in the afternoon because all these women want to go home and make dinner and get their families going for the evening. The men came and asked her if she could make a similar program for men. So she now has a program that starts an hour or two after the place closes for women, and men in her community are now getting college degrees through the Haredi College for Women. Of course, I'm sure it's now being called the Haredi College for Men. But it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And she really opened up a whole new area. Of course, I present the things as being so wonderful, all the opportunities that are open in the world now. There are still groups in Jewish life that are not giving women a proper education. And in fact, whenever I had Iranian girls in the Shebach High School, where I worked for 14 years in Queens, they told me they loved getting the education, but it was really unpreparing them for marrying Iranian boys, because the Iranian boys were not ready to marry girls who had an education. And there was a very strong feeling of, why can't you be the way your mothers were? And my husband asked them once when he came along at a Shabbat home, well, how were your mothers? What did they do when they came to shul if they didn't learn how to read Hebrew in Iran? The girl said, well, they talked in shul. And my husband says, then what happened? She said, then a man would get angry and one of the gabbaim would come over and yell at them. I said, so that was shul for your mother? That's what they want you to have? That should be shul? So they said, well, that's why we're in Shabbat High School. We want to have something different. We want to know what the davening is all about. We want to know what we're saying. We want to be able to say. We want to know what we're saying. So there are some things yet to be ironed out. The whole world is not rosy. But I hope that with acculturation, with being part of the 21st century world, that this will yet get resolved as well. We really have to think about where we go from here. In the same way that we're told that 1,000 enter into learning and only a few become the very great people in learning, the same thing is going to happen with women. Yes, it's wonderful that all this is open to everybody. First of all, not every girl wants Gemara. At Mayanot High School in Teaneck, which was founded on the idea of girls learning Gemara, girls came and asked, could we have a Tanakh track instead? They were not everybody wanted to learn Gemara. So now they have two tracks at Mayanot, the Gemara track and the Tanakh track, which I think was a very wise reaction to the reality of what people are ready to study. Gemara is not easy to study. It's another language. It's a whole logical system. It takes a lot of learning to become proficient in Gemara. It takes many years. And one is not proficient in Gemara because one had a few hours a day in high school and had a year or two in Israel. That does not make one into a Talmid Chachama. There's a lot more to it. And the question is, what are we going to do now? Where are we heading? Are we going to subsidize girls' learning so that young women can devote that kind of time to learning? Do young women want to devote that kind of time when they're at their childbearing years? Will they want to do it later? There's a whole host of questions now. But the important thing is, if you do learn as much as you learn and as profoundly as you learn, that's how much more connected to Torah you are. So we're not going to have any pretensions about anything. We just want that connection to Torah. That's what matters as the big first step. And the second thing is that our halachic practice becomes much more meaningful the more knowledgeable that we are. And it's just as a matter of being a real Jew, an understanding, thinking, analytic, comprehending Jew, learning is necessary. So it's a wonderful thing that women are learning, and the more we learn, the better off we are. And let's hope the future holds good things for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take, anybody have any questions?
Will you be good? Okay.
So if anybody has any questions or you want to ask after?
Okay. Yes.
I just wanted to say my mother came from Lithuania, okay, and she came in 1920. But she always had, she must have, she never talked about anything, but I knew she was Russian, German. She did like 6-7 languages.
Yeah.
So she did go to some school, but she never mentioned it.
Well, she may have gone to one of these schools if she knew 6 or 7 languages.
It's a place called Balkovishk, which is near Mariupol.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know what they had.
So Mariupol is a sophisticated city. Well, I don't know about Balkovishk.
Well, it's right next door.
Yeah. So she may have, I mean, if she knew that many languages, she had to have gone to school.
Because she read Gorky. She read War and Peace.
Wow. Wow.
So, I mean, this I know. But you know, it came out since I've been in a conversation. She never spoke about this stuff. So.
Maybe she went to public school. Right. But I envy her that she could read War and Peace in Russian. It took me an entire summer to read it in English. And I only did because I was determined to prove that I was going to read this book. And that's how I did. Very impressive. But she didn't speak about it, very impressive.
I don't know what she did. It was like a hidden secret.
Yeah. Okay, a lot of things are now coming out about life in Europe that we had not known previously. Yes?
I want to say the reason that Slobodka made the boys dress so modern was a reaction to the Enlightenment movement.
Yes.
Because boys left many. Voloshin, Bialik describes that nobody was left in Voloshin because of the Enlightenment.
Yes.
So they had to do something to...
To counter it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Enlightenment made many young men feel, I want to get out of this enclosed life of the yeshiva, and I want to get out there in the big world. And what Slobodka was trying to prove through being so modern in dress and in understanding was, you don't have to leave Yiddishkeit in order to be a modern young man. Yeah.
And then I want to say, I had a teacher that went to this Tels, Yavnes School, and then she went to Eretz Israel, Palestine in those days, and she wanted to teach him that Yaakov. But Yaakov did not accept her.
Interesting.
Because she went to So she went to the Mizrahi school.
So that was the benefit of the Mizrahi school.
Yeah.
Because the women who went to the Yavne and Tells, and let those who are alive still let them live and be well, and those who are gone, Aleihem Shalom, they knew Dikduk better than anybody else. They really knew Hebrew. They knew accents. So then it was to the benefit of the schools where she went.
Yeah.
Yes.
Going back to the question of why history was revised, could it be partially because after the Shoah, when people came and they wanted to rebuild Orthodox Judaism, sometimes when there's attempts at by assimilation to rebuild things, there's a tendency to move to the right to make it seem all the more stricter in order to pull it stronger or sort of thing.
I think that's an excellent explanation, and that also explains why a number of people, when they become Balei Tshuva, when people return to religious life, they often want to go to the far right. And so they want to show, I left all that behind, and now I'm going as far to the right as I can. It's not because it's more authentic. It's just because it takes away any temptation to slide back to where you were. But it's an interesting observation, and a very good one. Yes?
I propose a question. Of where do we go from here? The fact that these educational opportunities are so flourishing is outstanding. My question is, how do you see this education being translated into positions of leadership in the Jewish community?
Okay, we see it already, that there are so many female principals of schools now, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And in fact, I find it very interesting that at the Jewish Educational Center in Elizabeth, the principal of the boys' high school is Chani Moskowitz, and she's a woman. And why did that happen? Because when the previous principal left, the teachers all came to my brother, Rabbi Tice, who's now the dean of the school, and they said, she is so effective. She's been the assistant principal for several years. Why don't you just promote her to principal? And one of us will be in charge of the Gemara program. But let her be the principal. My brother said, when you have 8 or 9 men who are teaching Gemara come to you to tell you she is the most effective principal around, you better listen. So Chani Moskowitz is the principal of the boys' high school, and Rabbi Salber is in charge of the Gemara program. And I think that's what can happen now. That's what can happen. Now, I'm not saying that's happening everywhere. Mostly it's girls' high schools or co-ed schools where women are getting positions of leadership. But I think that's a remarkable thing.
Do you see, just a follow-up, do you see room for leadership in other aspects of Jewish communal life? Synagogues, I know that women are becoming heads in the broader Jewish community of JCCs and things like that,
right.
which are not to be sneezed at,
right.
Outside the Orthodox community.
I'll tell you, there are two questions here. First of all, is the question of how the whole idea of Sarara gets interpreted, how Halacha is. Sarara means having rule over another person, having... What would we believe the translation is?
Domination.
Domination. Okay, having...
It's
authority. 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 Sarara would be authority. Okay, right. But there is a fear of domination. There's a whole question of what Sarara means. And that is the question that's being debated right now. Another, for example, there's one Rosh Hashiva at Yeshiva University who said very clearly he thinks that women should not be presidents of shuls. I find it interesting because I've seen presidents of shuls, and I don't think it's Sarara at all. I think it's Avodas Para. It's backbreaking work. To be an officer of a shul is a very hard job, and you are a meshubad. You are very much the servant of people when you take a position of leadership in this community. So I just find it an interesting discussion. I don't know where that's going to go. I know that that's being discussed right now. I do think we have to take a lesson, though, from the conservative and reform movements and what happened there. Because as women were counted in the minyan, and as women became chazaniot, and as women became the rabbis, I don't know if you've read any conservative or reform rabbinic journals recently, but I have, there's a concern about the feminization of the temples, and that men are staying away in droves. If you go to a Friday night service, it's all women. And you go to many different things, and it's all women. And the men only come back for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and a bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah that they're invited to. So it's interesting that when women take over, I don't know if the same thing will happen again, but elementary school teachers used to be all men. Then when it became women, now you see 90% of elementary school teachers are women. Secretaries used to be men. And then when women became secretaries, no man would be a secretary anymore, except... I was going to say Secretary of State, but we've got a woman there. So it's something to think about. I don't think we've reached a real consensus on that yet. And of course, if there's a halakhic question involved, then we have to go to halakhic sources to see. So I'm afraid to answer on that without knowing better what would be the appropriate thing to say.
Can we, Dr. Blau, are you able to answer questions?
Yes. Okay.
Afterwards.
Can I just say one thing?
Absolutely.
That your mother and I worked together. That's when I was at the Orthodox, her mother
and
was
people
my,
dormed at my house. So
yes, like this. Right, like chills. Right. Her mother was the associate principal, and I was trying to finish my thesis. So 2 days a week, her mother ran the school, and 3 days a week, I ran the school. So it was a very good partnership. Okay. Go ahead.
So anyway, I want to thank Dr. Blau very much for coming, starting off our meeting. I think everybody is able to take away something from this, and hopefully...
Oh, but one thing you can't take away. You can't take away the source sheets.
Okay.
Because it's from the archives at YU, and Shuli Berger, the archivist who copied them for me, said I can't give them out to keep. She said, I'm allowed to give them out, but I have to collect them at the end. Okay? There's all
I thought it'll be like the Torah Shabbal Peh that we were talking about. Okay. I just want to make a few announcements and one plea. First of all... on September 20th, I think most of you have this over here, there is a second annual dessert reception for the mikvah. And we know we got our plug for the Yoetz of Halacha here, so let's all give or at least show up to the dessert reception. It's obviously, I don't need to stress how important it is. There's also on September 21st a book launch tour for a daughter's recitation of the Mourner's Kaddish by Rachel Berkowitz. It's going to be at Suri and Eitan Halpern's house. It's part of the Tashma program. It is at 8:30 on Wednesday, September 21st, and I encourage all of you to come. It's a really source-based, interesting approach to an interesting topic about women reciting the Kaddish. Also, I was thinking a little bit about September 11th and thinking what a horrible day it is for us and what a wonderful idea it would be to all of us to do a little me'afela la'ora, be able to do a mitzvah on the day that to commemorate September 11th, and if all of us could take out our checkbooks and write a check on September 11th for Midrashat Yom Rishon, it would be a way to take the day and make it a little bit more positive, and then you'd have a memento of something positive done. So, everybody.
What are the sponsorship levels?
Oh, the sponsorship levels will come out when we have sponsors. So, besides our obviously our wonderful sponsor Leslie Litsky from today. So next time we will have a sponsorship. It's $500 for the program, $360 for the brunch, etc. But whatever you give us, we will be more than happy to accept. And we look forward to a wonderful, wonderful fourth year. Thank you.
I wanted to say thank you. My bubby went to this school in college. I don't know if I can.
Wow.
If there's any way that I can hang on to this sheet, or maybe I could write.
No.
Okay. I would love it. I actually wrote this.
I wrote all over mine.
Yeah. But So I mean, it's amazing because my bubby. You knew my bubby, right? In other words, my great grandfather, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe's daughter-in-law, as my Zaidi Shomer. So she. I mean. So my Zaidi, my great-grandfather was Yaakov Moshe Lessin.
Right.
So his son,
right.
Israel Meir Lessin.
Right.
And then my Babi was Malka.
I didn't know that.
You didn't know her. Okay.
So she was the Rabbi Lessin was the essence of Saba. He was the epitome of Saba.
So she used to always say, I know in Yiddish, I know a pasuk, and she would throw around something. She was the one who went to my great-grandfather,
right.
Who was the rabbi of the town, in addition to being a Saba.
Right.
And said to him, I need to meet with you because I want to have a private meeting. And she said to him, is love, and I love Meir, and we want to get married because my Zaidi was too timid for this to be orchestrated. So she used to always throw in something.
I am so impressed with that story.
Yeah,
it's a great
which is
story.
Amazing. So that's my grandmother on one side, but my other grandmother, Elaine Wolf.
Right.
So she went to Yeshiva Flatbush.
Right.
Well,
look what a partner she was with her husband. They
correct.
Created the whole great nation.
That's right. But it's interesting because she also, it wasn't an exclusively girls' school. It was a co-ed school, but she was learning Gemara in the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah. I learned Gemara in the 1920s.